Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. Early in the morning of October 1st, 1910, an explosion tore through the offices of the Los Angeles Times. The cause was a bomb that had been planted outside the building. 21 people were killed, and the building was destroyed. The newspaper called it the crime of the century, and it made headlines across the country. This was a big story, but today it's mostly been forgotten. In this hour, we'll talk about this story, the story of one of the first acts of domestic terrorism in the nation's history. And the story is told in a book that has recently been published. The title of the book is American Lightning, Terror, Mystery, and the Birth of Hollywood and the Crime of the Century. It is published by Crown, and the author is Howard Bloom. He is the author of 8 previous books. He's currently contributing editor at Vanity Fair. He also worked for the New York Times as a reporter, where he won a number of awards for his work and was twice nominated for the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting. He's joining us this morning by telephone to talk about his book, American Lightning. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number, if you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That would mean that if it would be a long-distance call, so you're listening on the air around Illinois or Indiana, or for that matter across the country if you're listening on the Internet, you may use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Either way, calls are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their comments brief so we can keep moving along, but anyone is welcome to call. Mr. Bloom, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Pleasure to be with you.
Just to start off, let's just give us a basic description. What happened on that day, that early morning, October 1st, 1910?
Well, a bomb was placed in the wing of the Los Angeles Times building, actually in the alleyway where the printer's ink was stored. This bomb, when it went off, ignited the printer's ink, and there were a series then of 6 successive explosions, and one wall of the wing of the building began to tumble down, and the other wing, people were trapped inside, and they jumped, many jumped to their death to avoid the flames and the smoke. Some were rescued, but by the time the fire had been put out, they found that 21 people were dead, and now the city of Los Angeles was faced with the question, who did it? There were a number of immediate suspects. It could have been anarchists. It could have been labor unions. It could have even been, some people believe, the owners of the Los Angeles Times, who did it to collect the insurance money. And this was the great mystery that confronted the nation.
Was it obvious right from the start? Clearly, it was obvious to the people at the paper that this was not an accident. This was an intentional act. Was it, in fact, obvious that this was a bomb and not something else?
Well, as in all great mysteries, it was obvious to those people who had a certain predisposition to believe that there were political forces involved. Other people, the labor unions, were vehemently arguing that this was a gas leak, that the Harrison Gray Otis, the man who owned the Los Angeles Times, had allowed this to happen to collect the insurance company. Otis was the symbol, really, of anti-labor agitation in the United States. At this point in American history, it looked as if there might be another civil war. Workers were poised against employers. There was a real divide between labor and capital, and people from both sides were pointing fingers at the other.
Mm. Well, and that would suggest why it is that immediately suspicion would be focused on someone who was a union activist, that labor would somehow be involved, and that this would have a political dimension because the newspaper, in the editorial stance it had taken, was intensely anti-labor.
Yes, it was. You know, the paper, as run by Otis, was a closed shop. It would not hire union employees, and the unions had made up their mind that somehow they were going to break the back of the Los Angeles Times and also break the back of the merchants' associations in Los Angeles that wanted the entire city to be a closed shop city, that is, not to hire union workers. And they focused their dissent on strikes around the Los Angeles Times, and there was a series of over 20 strikes within 2 years in Los Angeles trying to break this anti-union stance.
Mm-hmm. And just I don't want in any way, shape, or form to excuse what happened, but in looking at what happened and the damage that was caused by the bomb and how what happened was the bomb exploded. Damaged gas lines. There were flammable material there. One wonders whether the people who and we'll talk about how this played out. But one wonders whether the people who planted the bomb had in mind that level of damage. Whether perhaps they would have been surprised at the result.
I mean, that is the argument that they made after the fact. When you plant a bomb in a building where people are working on in the night shift, you know, the newspaper comes out in the morning. You're being very promiscuous and very negligent in this trying to make a political argument.
So there are a number of interesting and outsized characters involved in this story. Early on, we see one who becomes involved here in the investigation. This was a man who was maybe one of the best known detectives in America at the time. And what's really great about this story and appealing about a character is he's one of those people who, if you made him as a fictional character, you'd say, well, this guy's kind of over the top. Well, the fact of the matter is this was a real person, and he was who he was, and he was a remarkable individual.
Yes. When the bomb went off in the city of Los Angeles, the mayor of Los Angeles, Mayor Alexander, wanted to find out who did it. So we turned to William J. Burns. William J. Burns was, as the New York Times called him, the American Sherlock Holmes, a great detective. For years he had worked with the Secret Service and solved many headline-making crimes, a counterfeiting scheme, the attempted assassination of the British ambassador. President Teddy Roosevelt had sent him into San Francisco to clean up the city. And just eight months before the bombing in Los Angeles, he'd gone on to his own. He had now decided that he wanted to become rich. He set up a private detective agency. And he was coming out to Los Angeles on the day of the bombing to give a talk to his new clients, the American Bankers Association, when this event occurred. He's also, at this point in Burns' life, his personal life was in turmoil. His oldest son, a son he loved and adored, had died recently of pneumonia. And he now was working with his younger son. And his younger son, in his eyes, really wasn't up to his older son's great accomplishments. And this depressed Burns a great deal. He also was depressed by the fact that he was out of the spotlight. Yes, he was making money working for bankers, but he wasn't getting the big headlines that he needed, that he sought. So now finally he was given this case, and he thought he would begin an investigation. He would find the men involved in the bombing. It would just be a rather routine investigation, but get some headlines. But what he goes on and what takes him for the next 7 months is a trip really across the country looking to see who was involved in this bombing. And he discovers not simply a plot to bomb the Los Angeles Times, but he discovers a record of over 103 bombings all across America over the past 3 years. And he determines that the nation's future is at stake, and he obsessively goes out to get the men involved.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that you might say either it's a great piece of investigative work or a great piece of luck, or maybe something of both, is that they managed to find a bomb, an unexploded bomb, interestingly enough, in Peoria, and another one that had been planted I guess the intention was that it was going to go off at around the same time as the one in Los Angeles. And when they set these two things side by side and looked at the way that they were made, they figured, well, they had to be made by the same person.
Right. Burns does very early criminal crime scene investigation, sort of like the TV show Now, looking for the clues. When the bomb was left at the Peoria train station, it had been set there to blow up a girder that was being used in a bridge being constructed by non-union workers. The police just ignored it, but Burns' agents dutifully took the unexploded bomb, took the components, put it into their offices in Chicago, and then 3 months later, it became very valuable to them in this investigation as Burns went around the country trying to see who had bought the dynamite for the Peoria bomb and tried to trace him to the bomb that went off in Los Angeles. In this pursuit, he goes off to San Francisco looking for clues, then on to Seattle. He goes into an anarchist colony. He goes undercover in the anarchist colony. When he gets to the anarchist colony, there's a major dispute going on between the nudes and the prudes. That is, many people in the colony don't want people swimming in the waters off Seattle without swim trunks on. Even this anarchist colony is divided over this. The editor who writes an editorial in support of the nudes goes to jail for 6 weeks because of this, and Burns finds himself in this world as he begins his investigation.
Hmm. Just real quick, let me again introduce our guest, Howard Bloom. He's author of the book American Lightning, which takes a look at the bombing of the Los Angeles Times. This happened in October of 1910. It was intentional. A bomb set outside the building triggered off a much bigger explosion. 21 people died. It destroyed the building and was a big story at the time, although, as we said, now it's one of those stories that people say, well, gee, I've never heard of that. You can read about that in the book. It's American Lightning. It's published by Crown. It's been out for a little while now. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Well, maybe you can, again, the complete story is in the book here, but you can talk a little bit more about how it is that Burns tracked down these men and found out who it was who had bought the explosive and were responsible for placing the bomb.
Well, a key element was he realized that this sort of 80% dynamite would be bought in San Francisco. So he goes around San Francisco for a period of weeks looking to find the men who were involved. He gets a lead at a rooming house where the dynamite had been picked up. At this point, everyone's using pseudonyms. He then tracks these people from the rooming house to a hunting trip in the woods of Wisconsin. He and his men go undercover in the woods of Wisconsin again, looking for these people. Finally, his son picks up a loop, follows one of them into Indianapolis, leads him to a labor official, the McNamara, James McNamara. They then realize the McNamaras are involved, and they have to make an airtight case to get the McNamaras, to get the union people involved. And they are able to make this case. And then once they get the McNamaras, just as we did with terrorists today, they sort of throw the law right out the window. Burns puts them in preventive detention. He suspends habeas corpus. He sneaks them off to Los Angeles to stand trial, and he intercepts their messages. He coerces confessions. They walk all over their constitutional rights.
I think initially he told them that what they were being arrested for was in fact something completely different, and that they agreed to cooperate because they figured, well, they could prove that they didn't have any. It was a bank robbery, he said, but they could prove that they didn't have anything
right
to do with that.
They agree to leave Indianapolis to go back to Chicago, but they don't agree once they get to Chicago. They're not thrown into a jail. They're thrown into a house outside the city where they're held incommunicado. Confessions are coerced, and they lose all basically their legal rights. It becomes, in effect, a kidnapping.
So
it's a secret prison and another kidnapping, which sounds relatively familiar in these times.
What was the motivation, or what was the allegation was the motivation for them to be involved in these bombings?
Well, the logic, as they explained it, was laborers had no rights. Here, employers were making extravagant salaries. The Los Angeles Times and other businesses across the country were not employing union people. Here were union workers trying to make the case that we wanted to be hired. We had a right to be hired. We had a right to earn a fair living. We have a right to support our families. And if we can't make this through just our protests, we'll do it through bombs.
Let's talk a little bit about another feature of this, which would seem to be it's sort of difficult to understand how exactly this connects. And that has to do with Hollywood and with filmmaker D.W. Griffith.
When Burns had, early in his career as a private detective, Burns had worked with D.W. Griffith. Movies were just in their infancy. They really were just 9-minute shorts. And he had seen a short by D.W. Griffith about a kidnapping. And he thought he could use this to coerce a confession out of someone he thought was involved in the murder of a young girl. And he borrowed this movie from Griffith, and he was able to get his confession. And they became friends. Once Burns went out to Los Angeles, he finds that there is D.W. Griffith staying at the same hotel. They renew their friendship. They all stay at the Alexandria Hotel in downtown Washington. And Griffith at this point was really inventing films. Every day he was like an explorer going out to new territory, trying to see how much farther he could take this new invention, this new media of film. One day he would move the camera up and he would invent close-ups. He decided that there should be stars. And he was caught up in the Los Angeles bombing, too. And as their lives intersected, he began to develop a political consciousness. Griffith realized that films could be editorials. He did a movie called A Corner in Wheat, where he decides that the wheat market is really being controlled by greedy speculators. And it's a very searing indictment in just 8.5 minutes of speculators and the plight of the poor in the United States. He makes a series of these political films, and the whole Los Angeles bombing, through his friendship with Burns and the events around that are happening in Los Angeles at this time, helps him to develop this political consciousness. And it also happens that as the case progresses, as suspects are caught, there's a movie made about the suspects, and afterwards there's a movie made about the entire case, which is a bit of a fantasy, but as we'll talk about Clarence Darrow plays himself in the movie and becomes a movie star.
How did people, people across the country, react to this story? And particularly, was there, I'm sure, among people who were involved in organized labor, there were a lot of concerns about how the case was conducted, how the rights of the accused were trampled. Generally speaking, though, how did people think about this? And was there, in fact, much sympathy for the men who were accused of this crime?
The McNamara brothers, who were accused of the crime, became a rallying point for people all around the country. People wore buttons on their lapels with the words kidnaps and photographs of the McNamaras on their lapels. The unions raised a fantastic sum, well over $280,000 from supporters around the country to pay for their defense. They were convinced, people like Gompers, Eugene V. Debs, that these men were innocents, that this was a frame-up, that they were kidnapped. They believed that Burns had manipulated the evidence against these innocent men. And so they took the money that they raised and they convinced Clarence Darrow to get involved in the case. Now, at this point in Clarence Darrow's career, he had given up basically being involved personally in great causes. He had come back to Chicago from a trial in Idaho, a union trial, and he was sick and he was broke, and he decided to devote the rest of his life basically to earning money till he could retire. He was involved when the Los Angeles Times bombing occurred. He was involved in a case in a suburb of Chicago where he was representing a firm accused of stealing the pension of a Civil War veteran, and he was defending the firm.
That's not exactly the kind of thing I would expect of Clarence Darrow.
Clarence Darrow's whole conduct in this case is very puzzling and very disturbing, and then something I had never known about, one of the things that provoked my interest in this. As the case goes on, Darrow's mistress comes out, a woman 27 years younger with him is out there in Los Angeles as he tries to defend these people. His wife is also living at the Alexandria Hotel. As Darrow becomes involved in the case, just as Burns is, he realizes two things. One, that these men are guilty, and two, if he somehow doesn't get them off, they're going to hang. And he decides to do whatever necessary to prevent these men going to the gallows. So he begins to do a couple of things. First, he goes to some of the witnesses involved in the case, and they offer bribes. His agents go to where them down to different parts around the country and say, we'll get you jobs, we'll give you cash if you change your testimony. When this doesn't work, Darrow then goes to one of Burns' lieutenants, and he approaches him and gives him, in the lobby of the Alexandria Hotel, $500 to be a spy in Burns' camp. This man, though, is really a triple agent. He is reporting back to Burns that Darrow has bribed him, and they're passing disinformation to Darrow through this agent. Then, when all else seems to fail, when Darrow realizes these men are going to be convicted, that they're going to be hanged, he makes a very monumental decision. He decides to bribe jurors, and he sends his agents out to bribe jurors, and when money is being passed, the agent is arrested. Darrow is right nearby, and Darrow is indicted for jury bribery. Darrow goes on trial himself for 3.5 months, and the evidence against him is overwhelming. Finally, at the end of this 3.5 months trial, Darrow himself stands up and to make a summation in his own case, and as he never says really that he's innocent. His testimony is very effective, but it's interesting. He says, if I've been human, well, my crime is that I've been too human. And tears are streaming down Darrow's face. And in the jury box, the jurors are crying, too, in support of him. And so the case goes to the jury, and Darrow is acquitted, even though the evidence against him was overwhelming.
Well, I suppose that's a testament to his ability to make an argument. It still seems sort of staggering that somebody of his stature would be so desperate to win a case that he would resort to jury tampering.
Yes, I mean, it's overwhelming, and Darrow seems to have learned from this, you know, oh my gosh, what have I done? He redirects his life to causes he can believe in, and there's no other further evidence of his ever tampering with a jury again. But at that point was his lowest moment. At one point, he goes to his mistress's house with a bottle of whiskey and a gun in his pocket, and he's prepared to commit suicide. He stays up all night talking to her and says he can't stand the shame. He's going to be convicted for jury tampering. And she finally convinces him not to do it, and he goes back and fights. But he's at the lowest point of his life. He's a man who's totally broken.
Was there
at the same time, yep, to put it in some perspective, you know, Burns is not playing fair. Burns comes up with this ingenious device. The dictaphone has just been invented. So Burns gets the idea of putting the dictaphone in the prisoner's cell in Darrow's conference room, and he's hiding this. He's getting daily transcripts of what the opposition is saying, so he knows exactly what's in the opposing counsel's mind throughout the trial.
Was there, and on the side of the defense, on Darrow's side, you would have thought that he would be the kind of person who at least could mount a defense that would say, yes, okay, they did it, but... and they could first of all argue that the intent was not to cause all this destruction and loss of life, but the intent was to make some sort of dramatic statement to show, you know, to dramatize the plight of the working man, and go on to make this very impassioned kind of argument that while they might have done something that was wrong, that resulted in death, that was not their intention, and that what they had in mind was some kind of, you know, higher purpose,
right,
in doing this.
The political stakes, it seemed for a while, were too high for that. When I say that, what I mean is, at this point, there was a mayoral election coming in Los Angeles. And Los Angeles, the primary, was won by the socialist candidate. And the socialist candidate was supporting the innocence of the McNamara brothers. And it looked like Los Angeles was about to elect a socialist mayor, as a few other cities had done in America at the time, in Wisconsin, in Buffalo, New York. And if this were going, this could never happen if the McNamaras pled guilty. And ultimately, this is what convinced the powers that be why they had to accept a guilty plea from the McNamaras, because they could not allow a socialist mayor to win in Los Angeles. Why couldn't they allow a socialist mayor to win? Because a socialist mayor would have prevented their issuing city bonds to promote an aqueduct, which would allow the investments they had made in the San Fernando Valley, this cabal of people who ran Los Angeles, to reap vast fortunes.
We're on our midpoint here, and let me again just introduce our guest, Howard Bloom. He's a writer. He has authored 8 books, 9 including the one that we're talking about here. He's currently a contributing editor at Vanity Fair magazine. He also was a reporter at the New York Times and won a number of awards for his work. He was twice nominated for the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting. And the book that we're talking about here, if you'd like to read it, is titled American Lightning, Terror, Mystery, and the Birth of Hollywood and the Crime of the Century. It is published by Crown, and it is in part about this event, something now at the time that was certainly big news, very big news, but now I'm sure most people have forgotten. This was a bombing that took place in October 1st of 1910, a bombing of the Los Angeles Times, and the book is about that event and about the trial that followed. Questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And we have someone here who'd like to join in the conversation, someone who is in Indiana on our line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Well, if anyone ever writes a history of your show, David, sure have one here with the one that preceded it, from the plight of children to Clarence Darrow's mistress and tampering. It's incredible. In that respect, I'd like for your guest, if he could, because this little analogy or whatever shows up a lot, and that's that water situation out of Los Angeles. Got Chinatown, the movie, and there's been a number of novels. There's a lot of stuff about it. I wonder if he could speak to that somewhat to sort of enlighten us just what was going on there. As much money as everybody says that was going to be made was made. And I just wondered how that worked itself in all that. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Sure. I mean, the Chinatown movie that the caller mentioned was inspired by these real-life events. What happened was Harrison Gray Otis, the owner of the Los Angeles Times, and a group of his wealthy friends had come up with a scheme to develop the San Fernando Valley. San Fernando Valley was just desert land. It was nothing. It was close to Los Angeles, but the idea of it becoming a suburb seemed impossible unless they could get water delivered to the San Fernando Valley to build an aqueduct from Sierra Nevadas to the San Fernando Valley. It would be something like $21 million. So rather than pay for it themselves, these investors got the city of Los Angeles to build this aqueduct. Bonds were raised. They diverted the water on its way to Los Angeles to the San Fernando Valley. So suddenly, this worthless land that they had bought for a few dollars an acre was now being able to turn into a suburbia. They were able to carve towns out of it, and they made a fortune from it. The one problem with this scheme, however, would have been if there had been a socialist mayor. A socialist mayor would not have allowed the city to put forward a $21 million bond offering that would enrich these speculators.
All right. Well, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We were talking a little bit earlier about how this case proceeded, Darrow's difficulty in trying to defend the men, his being accused of jury tampering and so forth. It seemed to come down to the point where he didn't have much choice, or maybe his best choice was actually to try to work out some kind of a deal, to negotiate a guilty plea in exchange for something. So, you know, what was at stake here? What was everybody hoping to get? What did they have to give if these two men that had been charged actually were willing to plead guilty?
Well, for a while, the two men were not willing to plead guilty, and the unions all across America certainly didn't want a guilty plea. They felt these men were being framed. They didn't want the union's honor to be impugned. The majority of the unions, the American Federation of Labor, for example, had no idea what this Indiana union was doing. So they did not want to make a settlement. At the same time, Darrow did not want to see these men hanged. At one point, there was a discussion that would be maybe an argument of justifiable homicide in the way that that the people involved in the building were agents of the anti-union forces in the way they deserved to die. It's the same sort of argument, interestingly enough, that was made on 9/11 for the people in the World Trade Center. The people who bombed that said that those people deserved to die because they were agents of the American capitalism system too, Western imperialism. Darrow could see no way out of it, and he went into this vast depression. And finally, he decided that he would try to convince the McNamara brothers to cut a deal. And the only reason that the city, again, of Los Angeles accepted this deal was because of the bond issuance. They did not. If the McNamara's, if the trial was not settled, the McNamara's were acquitted, then a socialist mayor they felt would have been elected in Los Angeles. They never would have gotten their aqueduct, and people would have lost fortunes.
So the two men pleaded guilty. They went to jail. What happened to the McNamara's?
One went to jail for 30 years, the other one for 15. They came out of jail, and their lives, they just basically disappeared from history. They never played a role in unions anymore. Unions in Los Angeles never really achieved their full strength for the next 25 years. Interestingly enough, D.W. Griffith was one of the big supporters of unions in Los Angeles. He was one of the first filmmakers to hire union filmmakers, union cameramen. He saw the what he felt was the rightness of their cause.
Yeah, this and perhaps you've in a sense spoken to this already. But you know, one of the things that's interesting here to think about is when you say that this is something that happened in Los Angeles. I suppose what people will think about is Los Angeles today. Well, Los Angeles today is not what Los Angeles was like in 1910. You think that there were many important ways in which this the outcome of this case then determined what Los Angeles came to be.
Yes, in many ways, you know, Los Angeles came to be a city with suburbs growing around outside of it because the water was allowed to come in. It was a city which for many years was anti-union. It wasn't until the Second World War that unions really got a hold in Los Angeles. San Francisco was always a pro-union city, and Los Angeles wasn't. But this real battle between labor and capital, which looked like it was going to erupt into a second civil war all across America, sort of went on to sort of resolved, in a sense, by the confession that the McNamara's were guilty. The pressure to force us to a full-pitch battle seemed to have been lost, and America sort of breathed a sigh of relief and went on to other things.
So this actually had a way of diffusing some of the tension at the time involving organized labor on the one hand and capital on the other?
Yes, in the sense that the guilt of the McNamara's, once they admitted it, was overwhelming. The case against them that Burns had made was overwhelming. Still, the bitterness on both sides was intense. For example, at Darrow's bribery trial, when Burns testified against him, laid out the evidence, the lawyer who was representing Darrow at the time, Earl Rogers, wound up getting into a fist fight with Burns in the hall outside the courtroom. This was a battle of very large personalities. It was a mystery story where people wound up caring about not just simply solving the mystery, but also putting America on the right path, the path they believed in. And because of that, they were willing to do anything to win.
How did the involvement in this case help to shape the future career of William Burns?
Well, Burns' celebrity was intensified. He, in the course of this drama, he also works out his relationship with his son, Raymond, and he goes on to be involved in many other cases, murders, mysteries all around the country, but finally decides to work for the government. And when the Bureau of Investigation, the precursor to the FBI, is established, Burns becomes his first head. but he has the job only for a number of months before the Teapot Dome scandal breaks. And he becomes involved in testifying before Senate committees, and he decides he's had enough. He doesn't want to work for the government anymore. He'd rather retire. So he gives his job, the head of the Bureau of Investigation, to his assistant, a man by the name of J. Edgar Hoover. And Hoover winds up in that position for the next 52 years, and the course of America's changed, too, because of that.
That's another little remarkable sort of wrinkle about this story. Our guest is Howard Bloom. Just let me mention one more time the title of the book. It's American Lightning, and it is published by Crown. Howard Bloom is now a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. He's also been a reporter for The New York Times. This is one of nine books that he has authored, and it tells indeed the story of the bombing in 1910 of the Los Angeles Times and the trial that followed and some of what happened to the people that were involved. It's an interesting story, so you might want to take a look at the book. And questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. After this, what happened to Clarence Darrow?
Well, Darrow, after this decision, decides that after the men plead guilty, after then he goes on trial for his own bribery, he decides he's been given a new lease on life. He breaks off with his mistress. He goes back with his wife. He moves back to Chicago. He becomes involved in great causes, Leopold and Loeb, the Scopes Monkey trial, and his place in history seems assured. And he, in his autobiography, he doesn't even really talk about the Los Angeles Times bombing case, and he certainly doesn't mention his own bribery trial. He doesn't mention that he was at the point of committing suicide because he knew his own guilt.
Mm. What was it that attracted you to this story in the first place? I would say, and I'm sure that there were a lot of other people would say, that this story to them is new, that they'd never heard of this before, even though, as I said, I'm sure at the time this was big news all the way across the country. What got you interested in this?
Well, primarily at the beginning, the fact that I had never heard about it. I saw a little item in the newspaper about the anniversary of the bombing of the Los Angeles Times. 21 people killed. I knew nothing about that. And then I thought, well, maybe this would just simply be a story for Vanity Fair. But then I do some investigation, realized the heft of the personalities involved. Here was Billy Burns, this great detective, who goes on a cross-country manhunt across America, like a turn-of-the-century Jack Bauer looking for terrorists, and becomes immersed in the case. Then you had D.W. Griffith, being his life intersecting with Burns as he's inventing the cinema, as each day he's going out to create a new media to change American culture. And then when I did some research and found out about Darrow's role in the whole case, and he was the great Clarence Darrow, this icon of American jurisprudence, and he was bribing jurists. That, to me, this connection and intersection of all these people at the turn of the century America, when the country was changing and lives were changing, and here were three strong-willed, very complex individuals caught in the middle of it, and I had a mystery story to tell to boot. That, to me, was an interesting book to write.
Mm. This must. I'm expecting that indeed this must have been something that at the time was a huge story. Had to be one of the biggest things going.
Yes, I mean there were rallies all around the country. The idea of the crime of the century, was headlines. The New York Times called it the crime of the century. The Los Angeles Times called it the crime of the century. And it's something when people learn about it seems to resonate today. As it's been sold to the movies, and hopefully within the next year or so it should be on the big screen. And I think people will look back in the past and they will see something that's happening today. Terrorism as it affects us today and how we deal with terrorists.
One of the interesting dimensions of this is that we talked earlier about the fact that the paper was a target because it had been so vehemently anti-union, and that it seems that I think some people thought that, in fact, that the guy who owned the paper expected that the paper would be attacked, and in fact had gone to the trouble of making sure that he had someplace else to print the paper, because after the building was destroyed, and this was the building that had the presses in it, that the paper didn't miss a beat. They immediately had a paper out, and the big headline on the paper was about the building being bombed, and the paper's allegation that they were making the claim right away that it was somehow people that were associated with labor that were responsible.
Yes, Otis was a very combative, hostile man. He was going out of his way for years to attack labor, and he was almost daring them to fight. When he was the first one to throw all union employees out of the Los Angeles Times, he drove around town in a car with a cannon mounted on the hood, ready to fend off any attackers. He called his house the bivouac because he was ready for attack. He wanted an attack to come in many ways, and the unions were ready to deal with it. At the AFL convention prior to the bombing, they said their first order of business would be to change the conditions of the Los Angeles Times. So the battle lines were being clearly drawn.
Did this have some kind of long-term implications for the newspaper, for the newspaper itself?
Well, for decades and decades, the Los Angeles Times was fiercely anti-union. It went on to talk and their editorials about labor agitators, and then on to communist spies for decades. They were big supporters of McCarthy. A lot of the reason of that was because of this, what had happened, their anti-union, early anti-union stance.
Mm. You know, when you talked about the fact that you got interested in the story just because you saw in you got interested in writing about this because you saw the story about the anniversary of the bombing of the paper, and you said, well, I've never heard of that. Why have I never heard of that? And got interested in it more and more, and developed that into American Lightning. It seems to me, and I, you know, maybe you have the same feeling, that there's something about this time, say the late 19th and early 20th century in America, that's really compelling. At least I sort of feel that way myself. I'm not exactly sure what it is about that time that's so compelling, but it is.
Oh, it's a very compelling time, because here was America about to achieve its full destiny and its full power. It had just come out of the Civil War. It was just being electrified. Machine age was coming in. Great fortunes being made. And people were having large ambitions. The idea we were inventing a whole new aspect of culture, the cinema, was coming into play. It was a time when America was feeling its strength and its confidence, and it had to resolve this dispute between labor and capital, which was about to cripple the whole country. And once it resolved that to a certain extent, it was able to move on.
And I suppose it's not understatement to talk about this in terms of a war. That's at least the way that people saw, that people thought about it, that what they felt about it, they worried about it, that they thought that really it was a kind of a war going on.
It very much was a time of war, just like if you can remember during the Vietnam era, in the last presidential election, you know, people were looking back and couldn't understand why bombs went off, why bombs were planted. It seemed so impossible, but at that point there was a feeling that America was at war between the people who supported it and the people who didn't.
We have time here. Certainly, if somebody wants to call in and get in a question or two, we have a couple of minutes left in this part of Focus 580. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you can certainly call and join in the conversation. Did the paper rebuild on that original site where the building was destroyed, and did they somehow commemorate that or put any kind of markers or monuments or anything like that on that place?
No. The paper rebuilt at another location nearby, and there's a plaque in the Los Angeles Times building that now stands about the bombing that occurred, but it's not the original site. The paper would like to move on from that episode and its history, but now the Los Angeles Times, like newspapers all around the country, is having its own problems. The future of newspapers is in doubt.
Yeah, for sure. Is this something that you think that even people in Los Angeles don't know about, this particular story?
Yeah. I mean, I did a, after the book came out and it was excerpted in Vanity Fair, I did an article for the Los Angeles Times about it. And there were many of the Los Angeles Times editors who didn't know about it. The idea that their paper had been attacked, 21 people working at the paper had been killed, came to them as a surprise.
Tell me some more about the movie that was made of this by D.W. Griffith. A little bit earlier in the interview, you said that he made this, that was something of a piece of fantasy.
D.W. Griffith actually didn't make the movie, but there were two movies made of the case that were inspired by what D.W. Griffith was doing. D.W. Griffith was making these politicized movies at the time. One was about the McNamara brothers. It was a martyr to their cause. It was a complete fairy tale. It was sheer political propaganda. The union made it for $2,337, and it wound up grossing something like $285,000. It was a tremendous success. After the trial was resolved, Frank Wolf, who was worked on Darrow's team, of the defense team, he was the publicist for the team. He was a former newspaper man, and he decided he'd go into the movie business, too. He had seen D.W. Griffith's movies, and he made a movie inspired by the case, a fictionalized version, but he had Darrow play himself, and Darrow, in front of the camera, gave the summation that he gave to the jury in his own bribery trial. And it's very affecting, and Darrow became a movie star, in effect, at this point in his career.
And have you actually been able to see this yourself?
Yes, I've seen parts of it. Parts of it are still existing, and I think there's a still from the movie shown in my book in the photo section, and you can see Darrow pleading to the jury in this movie based on his real-life appearance before the jury.
And he really, from what you have seen, comes across powerfully in that, in at least that little bit?
Amazingly effective. Another Brando. I mean, he captures the screen. He's a natural-born actor. And that's what's so interesting. All these people, the three main characters in the story, were larger-than-life figures. Billy Burns, D.W. Griffith, and Clarence Darrow were actors in their own lives, men who commanded the screen of daily life. There were large presence and men with tremendous egos. And in the process, they helped to shape America.
Perhaps one reason that the story would capture us is the kind of concerns, the issue of terrorism, if you want to call this terrorism, is still with us. And that maybe one reason that the story resonates is that it in some ways feels contemporary. Is there anything to be learned, do you think, from bringing back a story like this and introducing it to people who, all those people who say, well, I've never heard of this before?
On one level, it's a very good, I think, or compelling, entertaining mystery story. But I do think we can learn things. You don't want to make too fine a connection, but, terrorism is something. It's important to realize that terrorism is something not new to America, and that the excesses that were done in prior times, the suspension of habeas corpus, wiretapping, coercing confessions, those hurt the democratic process and the justice process back then, and I think they will hurt things now. They're things that undermine the morality of American life.
So you said that somebody has optioned this for movie rights, and of course, a lot of books get optioned. That doesn't necessarily mean that they actually go on to be movies.
Don't say that, please.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to jinx the chances. No, no, no.
You're quite accurate.
I don't want to do that. But one never knows. So you're really hoping that such a thing would happen, that it would go on and be a movie. Is this just really in the early stages of this business?
Well, it just happened. The book was just published 2 months ago. It came out, made the bottom of the New York Times list, and then the movie companies came calling, and there were several bidders, and we sold it to Wind Dancer Productions. And now they're talking in terms of actors who would be the best Billy Burns. They've issued statements to the Hollywood Press of Russell Crowe being Billy Burns. It should only happen, but as you say, between Hollywood promises and reality, sometimes falls a very large shadow.
Yeah. Russell Crowe. Well, that's a pretty good name to have attached to a project, even if that's only, for talking purposes.
Something nice
that's,
to think about before Christmas, yeah.
That's not bad, William. Russell Crowe. Well, we can watch for that. And anything else, any other names attached, like directors or actors or anything like that been suggested?
They issued a statement to Variety where they talked about Russell Crowe for Billy Burns, Robert Downey Jr. for D.W. Griffith, and then for Darrow, they were talking about Philip Seymour Hoffman. But again, these are, Hollywood producers talking, and their statements are being printed in Hollywood papers, and let's hope they come true. It would be a nice Christmas wish.
Well, that would be a pretty interesting cast. I'm here looking at a picture of Clarence Darrow and seeing Philip Seymour Hoffman. I think that would be okay.
Yeah,
I think that would work. All right. Well, what are you working on right now?
I'm just about to start another book. But this one is sort of a turn-of-the-century, true-life Western story that meanders on into Alaska. Of all places.
Yeah.
Seems to be in the news a bit lately.
Yeah. Well, the book, if you're interested in reading it, the title of the book is American Lightning. The subtitle is Terror, Mystery, The Birth of Hollywood, and The Crime of the Century, that it's about the bombing that took place in Los Angeles at the Los Angeles Times in the fall of 1910 and about the trial that followed. It's a good story. You can read it. The book is published by Crown. The author is our guest, Howard Bloom. He's currently a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. He also was a reporter at the New York Times, where he won a number of awards for his work. He was twice nominated for the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting there. And Mr. Bloom, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Nice speaking with you.